This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. I hear you talking when I'm on the street. When the Rolling Stones embarked on a farewell tour of Britain in March of 1971, there were no laminates, no backstage passes, and no sound checks. Just a rock and roll band in a bus playing new songs like Brown Sugar and Wild Horses, and a longtime creative partnership teetering on the brink. All that and a young journalist named Robert Greenfield. He was then at Rolling Stone magazine's London Bureau and was the only reporter to accompany the Stones on that tour before their self-imposed tax refuge on France's Mediterranean coast. Greenfield then joined them at Nelcote, Keith Richards' rented villa during the making of Exile on Main Street, one of the band's most critically acclaimed album. Ain't It Time We Said Goodbye, The Rolling Stones on the Road to Exile, is Greenfield's third book on the Stones. And Robert Greenfield, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Well, set us the general sky for us. The original band member, Brian Jones, then dead, the infamous Redlands bust behind them, the killing of a fan at Altamont. How was the band and its record company responding to all of the challenges?
Well, they had a new record company. You know, they had formed their own label, one of the first bands to do so, Rolling Stones Records. They had left Decca after many years of a bad contract. They had rid themselves of Alan Klein, who had also been managing the Beatles. They were broke. They owed the Inland Revenue in England a fantastic amount of money. They were in like the 95% tax bracket. Other than that, everything was really good. what nobody knew, because no one had heard it, was that they had finished recording Sticky Fingers. And Sticky Fingers becomes the beginning of the next chapter of the Rolling Stones' career. Nobody at that point knows that this is going to be their biggest album ever, that it is going to take off worldwide in a way that nothing they've ever done before has. It's going to be their most commercial album, their biggest success. Childhood living is easy. They're playing 2,000-seat venues, decrepit city halls that haven't been painted since like 1897, you know. And everything smells as things could only smell in England back then. They're doing two shows a night. And I am this kid who's never been on the road with anybody before. And I, every night I'm standing on stage, and the Stones would be doing Bitch, Brown Sugar, Wild Horses. No one had ever heard these songs. The album wasn't out. But they had to go on the road because they had to leave England by a certain date. And the tour itself was motivated really by a desire to go around their homeland for the last time. And on every level, symbolically and every other level, this really was the end of the first chapter of their professional career.
It was one of the things that prompted Keith Richards to try and kick his heroin addiction before the tour. Tell us a little bit about the impact of his addiction on the band.
Well, what was really fascinating about the Stones in general, and Mick and Keith in particular, is that by 1971, they had already been famous for 5 years. And as I say in the book, they, both Mick and Keith, were practiced at the art of deception. And so there was no knowing during the 10 days of the tour that Keith Richards, along with his very close friend Graham Parsons, late of the Byrds, mm-hmm. and the Flying Burrito Brothers, had undergone this horrific apomorphine cure recommended to them by William Burroughs, the author, in which they basically just lay in bed and were sick for, you know, it's really disgusting. I don't need to get into the details. They went through hell, they cleaned up, and they immediately started using again. And both of them, along with Keith's companion, Anita Pallenberg, the actress, were using heroin on this tour. But I didn't know that. I don't know who else on the tour would have known that. Things went on behind closed doors. Mick was then with Bianca, who became his first wife. No one knew that she was pregnant. It's really, if I may say, rock and roll days of our lives. A soap opera of major proportions where Mick and Keith are already traveling separately. And all the tension that's going to build and build in the south of France. The split that is coming between these two really creative geniuses musically. It's all there between the buttons, as we say.
We're talking with Robert Greenfield. He's a journalist, a screenwriter, and author of several books. Most recently, Ain't It Time We Said Goodbye? It's a pretty raucous insider account of his unprecedented access to the Rolling Stones at a really critical time in the band's career, the last tour before their self-imposed tax exile. A lot more is going on, and that's the real story here, Robert, about the pivotal change in the Rolling Stones' creative songwriting engine. Keith Richards and Mick Jagger. Now, you mentioned Richards was with the actress and model Anita Pallenberg, mother of his son. Mick, ready to marry or married to the exquisite Bianca Perez Morera de Macias. Tell us a little
Marina.
Bit. Sorry.
She had many names. She had many, many last
names. Let me try again. The exquisite Bianca Perez Morena de Macias.
That's it.
Tell us a little bit about her and her influence on Mick.
Oh, dear. Bianca was something. You know, she was completely self-created. She was extraordinarily beautiful. She was incredibly mysterious. She had an amazing accent. She dressed like Daisy Callahan. She smoked cigarettes out of long yellow ivory holders. She was one of the most exotic human beings I've ever encountered. And people didn't know what to make of her. She was not rock and roll. Anita was rock and roll. And everybody on the tour was concerned because, you know, whither Mick goest is whither goest the Stones. No one knew what it was that she wanted. Well, she wanted to marry him. And what I would think still ranks as the greatest rock and roll wedding of all time in Saint-Tropez that May, if only in terms of the guest list. As someone said, if that private plane had crashed on the way from London, the rock business would have been set back 100 years. Paul McCartney, Eric Clapton, on and on and on. Everybody attended that wedding.
You point to the kind of class-climbing, aspirational nature of Mick Jagger.
Yeah.
In fact, you call him a shapeshifter in the book at one point. Now, this is all kind of brought into focus at Mick's wedding to Bianca in March of 1971. You talked about the guest list. But what happened there that kind of signified the split between the soon-to-be-called Glimmer Twins, I guess?
Well, at the wedding, Keith does an enormous amount of a white powder substance that you put in your nose, which is not talcum. He gets to the civil ceremony late. They don't want to let him in because he looks like he's dressed like somebody who's hitchhiking through Europe. He starts choking. It could be the chief of police in Saint-Tropez. This gets settled. They admit him to the church, and he sits down on the bride's side after the wedding. There's a huge party at the Hotel Biblos, very exclusive in Saint-Tropez. And Keith authorizes someone to get people up on stage for what would have been probably the greatest rock and roll jam in the history of the universe. So, you know, here comes Clapton, here come all the stars. And so when the guy who's got everybody ready to play goes up to find Keith, he's passed out. And he, in fact, never gets on stage, never plays. And from that point on, then Mick goes on his honeymoon. I mean, the making of the album is detailed in a book I wrote about Exile on Main Street, but it couldn't have been more brutal, more laborious, more time-consuming. And then basically there are so many drugs going through that house, Villa Nelcutt, that the Stones are forced to flee for their lives. They're all about to be arrested and thrown into jail in the south of France.
Mm. Well, it's not just the two of them. It's the tensions between Bianca and Anita that are kind of spilling over, some of which you witnessed many times, but in particular before a gig in Liverpool. Now, what can you tell us about them that is safe for radio?
The rumor that was around was that on the previous tour, Bianca lent Anita some clothes. And if you'd seen Anita in action back then, God knows what she would have done in the course of an evening. And it seems like she returned them with so many substances that Bianca threw out the clothing. And I guess between two rock and roll divas. I guess it's kind of a Solange Beyonce situation.
Oh, he went there.
No kicking, but you know, it was a long time ago, you know.
But so you were assigned to interview Keith during this debauched summer following this tour. I'm remembering from Keith's biography that they got into a boat and had a great time in Italy.
Well, the name of the boat was the Mandrax.
That
kind of says it all. Go ahead.
But something worked, right? The descent worked. Even if they were unraveling, they made a great record.
Well, I was there in what I call the garden period. The mobile studio was there. They actually hadn't started recording in the basement. Keith had not yet started using heroin again. And this is very F. Scott Fitzgerald. But every day was a party. And it was just like, okay, what are we going to do today? We're going to go out on the boat. We're going to go water skiing. We're going to go drive around the south of France in my red Jaguar. He was having a great time. The point being that out of this cauldron, yes, out of this kind of hellish, summer that they had, they did come up with Exile. A lot of the music on Exile was not recorded during that period. People who love the Stones know this. They're versions of stuff that had been done at Olympia some years earlier. But that is Keith's album. That's Keith wanting to get back to rock and roll, wanting to play hard riffs, wanting to play the blues. As I always say, when Exile came out, double album, no one really knew what to make of it. People liked it. Some didn't like it. Stones were ahead of the culture at that point. And when they went out on the road in 72, it wasn't like they were playing the songs from that album. The big stuff was still Honky Tonk Women and Satisfaction. And basically, the great stuff they had done on the English tour the spring before.
Robert, it makes for a great read, this Days of Our Life portion of the book, but isn't it kind of simplistic to make Bianca the Yoko Ono of the band, or, you know, Anita the Linda McCartney, when it was actually Richard's addiction that he was truly wedded to? And that is why Mick later plotted to replace him, as you tell us in the book.
You know, this is completely true. It's not about the women who broke this band up. You know, all due respect to women everywhere. There are no women who can break this band up. You know, this speaks to the way Mick and Keith feel about their music. I mean, if Mick and Keith are not speaking to each other for huge periods of time, and yet they can lean into the same microphone and sing harmony on stage, and you think they're two brothers, that says a lot. So it's absolutely true that Bianca did not break up this band. Anita did not break up this band. You know, Keith went missing for so long that Mick had to take over all of the business and financial dealings, and really, and I think even Keith knows this at this point, were it not for Mick Jagger, the Rolling Stones would no longer exist. He's the one who on a daily basis has never stopped taking care of business, and you have to have somebody do that or else there is no business.
Robert Greenfield, former associate editor of the London Bureau of Rolling Stone magazine. He's author of several books on rock and roll. Most recently, Ain't It Time We Said Goodbye, The Rolling Stones on the Road to Exile. You can find much more on him and his work at wordofmouthradio.org. Robert Greenfield, what a pleasure speaking with you.
Virginia, thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure.
Thanks so much for your listening time today. If you like what you heard, there is much more at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us and send us your feedback or share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. We find the most fascinating stories get passed around by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Join us for more of them tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.